got three. I got to go.
Good morning. I'd like to call this meeting of House State Affairs to order. It is 8:06 on Thursday, May 2nd. And present are Representative Elkins, Representative Gatto, Representative Gardner, and Chair Seaton, Representative Lynn. We have a quorum. I wanted to remind everybody to turn their cell phones off before we start. And today we will hear, in this order, House Bill 485, and then 475, H.J.R. 25, and H.B. 344. In H.B. 485, there is an additional letter that came. So that's in your packet, and we were on public testimony. We had one person online yesterday. We have a list of that. Thank you. And also, would you check and see if there's anybody signed up? Thank you. Jim Duncan, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Thank you. In public hearing here, would you like to comment on House Bill 485?
Yes, I would.
Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Duncan. I'm business manager for the Alaska State Employees Association. Our union represents approximately 7,500 general government workers, state employees who are in the general government unit of the union. I would like to make several comments about the legislation, if I might, Mr. Chairman, and then be available if you have questions. But first, let me begin by saying that I listened to the testimony on Tuesday, and I have no disagreement with the statements made by representatives from the Department of Revenue, Department of Health and Social Services, and Department of Administration about the fact that pharmacists and corporate income tax revenue auditors are in a hard to recruit positions, that it's difficult to fill those positions, that those positions at the level of pay they currently are not competitive with the private sector and with the federal government in most cases, and that they need more pay. I have no disagreement with that at all. However, I would say that the approach in House Bill 485 to move those positions from classified service to exempt service is not the method, not the approach that should be used to solve this problem, because this issue exists not only with these two job classes, but with numerous other job classes in state government. I think Representative Gardner asked the other day, are there other hard-to-fill positions? And there clearly are. From my experience and background, I know there are a number of these classifications other than these two, which are hard to fill. So moving from classified service to exempt service is not the solution. In fact, just to be blunt, it's just a convenient and easy approach for management to resolve a problem instead of addressing the real underlying issue. So there are several points I would ask the committee to consider as you consider this legislation and what steps you want to take. And first, I would ask you to take a look at the state constitution, because there are some important constitutional provisions that relate to this piece of legislation and to any movement of positions from classified to exempt service. I'm sure you're all aware that Article 12, Section 6 of the Alaska State Constitution creates a merit system. And what it says is a very short statement, is that the legislature shall establish a system under which the merit principle will govern the employment of persons by the state. I can read just very briefly from the Alaska Constitution's A Citizen's Guide that was put together by Gordon S. Harrison for Legislative Affairs Agency. And what he says in interpreting that section is, a state civil service keeps state jobs from becoming political spoils of office, and it encourages the development of a competent, permanent workforce. Most permanent state employees are included in the state system, exempt are policy-level positions in each executive department, all employees in the governor's office, and all employees of the legislature. I think clearly pharmacists and the corporate income tax auditors are not considered policy-level positions. In a letter dated October 17th, 1994, that relates to this area, it was a letter from then Attorney General Bruce Botello to then Senator Jim Duncan. The following is said regarding this area. The Alaska Constitution requires that the legislature establish a system under which the merit principle will govern the employment of persons by the state. Alaska Constitution Article 12, Section 6, is that provision. Attorney General Botello in that letter goes on to say, this constitutionally required policy has been described by the Alaska Supreme Court as the weightiest public concern in the state employer's trust. And that statement was made in a Supreme Court case of Alaska Public Employees Association versus the state in 1992. I read that, or bring that to your attention, because clearly this should be a very weighty decision that you make, and it's a very important decision. It's clear from those writings and from what is said that moving into exempt service should not be done lightly, that the classified service was established for a specific purpose. In fact, if you would review, if you would have time, and I have done that, review the minutes of the Constitutional Convention when this part of the Constitution was being discussed by our founding fathers, quite a bit of time was spent on Article 12, Section 6, and the debate was around should it say the legislature shall establish or the legislature may establish. And after debate and discussion about what the intent was and the need to have competent career employees who weren't subject to political pressures and the spoil system, the constitutional founders, those who wrote the Constitution, voted 40-13 to say that the legislature shall establish. So this should not be done lightly. And I know you, Mr. Chairman, you and the committee members are considering it very carefully. And I would ask you to think about what it means if you're going to move positions into exempt service where they can become subject to political pressure, and they're appointed not based on their competency and professionalism, but on a political spoil system. For example, these corporate income tax revenue auditors charged with responsibility of the oversight of the tax system in the state of Alaska for multi-state corporations. They're charged with the responsibility of enforcing that and collecting it and being sure that the proper taxes and revenues are coming to the state of Alaska. I don't believe it's good policy to put those individuals who are charged with overseeing the collecting of revenues and enforcement of tax laws into exempt positions where they can be subject to political pressure. They can be changed at will by any administration. And those individuals that they're auditing could perhaps bring pressure back on the policymakers in state government, the bosses in state government, that would have impact on the ability of those corporate income tax revenue auditors to do their job and to do it well.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Can you go ahead and wrap up here?
Jim, I have quite a few other points I'd like to make. I didn't realize I had a limit on time. I can try to do that as quickly as possible, but there's several important points. If I could proceed just very quickly then, the classified system is not the problem. The pay plan within the system is the problem. So taking folks out of classified service does not solve the problem. It's the pay plan that needs to be addressed. Pay plans can be changed. The Constitution is clear, and the Supreme Court has ruled that pay plans are a mandatory subject of bargaining. Testimony was that even if they could increase the auditors and the pharmacists to arrange 30, or even if they could increase them, they couldn't do it under our collective bargaining agreement because we only go to arrange 27. Pay plans can be changed, they're meant to be changed, they're subject to bargaining. It's a mandatory subject to bargaining. In fact, I am preparing now a letter to the state asking them to go back to the table to discuss a new pay plan that would add those ranges that would be necessary to accommodate the needs of the pharmacists and the auditors. Third, the classification system can be changed, and I would ask you to ask these questions. The studies that they did were based on internal alignment, but they can also base them on external factors and can compare it to the market. I do agree that they compare internally with job class families to maintain internal alignment. I have no argument that they need to do that, but the question is, are they considering appropriate positions in those job class families? I believe, quite honestly, that revenue auditors, the responsibilities they have, probably do not compare very well with some of the jobs, are much more specific responsibilities than some of the jobs they compared with. Three other points real quick, Mr. Chairman, and then I will wrap up. Specifically on the pharmacist, I think the following question should be asked. What is the impact on funding of those positions by moving them to exempt service? I have copies of federal regs that require that individuals who are funded by federal grants be in a merit system. Pharmacist positions are federally funded to some extent, in about 50%. I don't know the answer, but the question is, will you lose that federal funding when you move them into exempt service? another constitutional provision, Article 1, Section 15, says that statutes can't impair a contract. This statute, with an effective date of July 1st of 06, would impair a contract, our collective bargaining agreement. Article 1.01 says that we will represent all folks who are in the classified service and GGU positions. The pharmacists and auditors are in GGU positions at this point. That prohibits this law moving them out of classified into exempt service. If the law should pass, we, of course, would have to take steps to challenge it as an impairment of a contract and challenge it on the constitutional basis. Finally, I think the process that is being used for revenue auditors is flawed. They have created a new class called forensic auditor. I cannot find a job description or a position statement as to how their duties differ from what is now a corporate income tax auditor for. I think they're one and the same. They're using this vehicle to say they're creating a new job class, but they're really the same duties that are being performed by revenue auditors for will be performed by the forensic auditors. They should have prepared a job description, asked for a new classification, sent that to personnel, had it reviewed, had personnel put them on a pay plan, and sent it back, and they did not follow the process. Just very quickly then, Mr. Chairman, there are several points I think you should consider. One, this is a flawed process. Secondly, it ignores the constitutional requirement of the merit principle. Third, it violates the provisions of our collective bargaining agreement by impairing a contract. Four, it ignores a mandatory subject of bargaining, that of a pay plan. And fifth, it puts corporate revenue auditors at will and subject to political pressure from those very people there to audit, and it puts them at the risk of, puts the state at risk of having the type of ability we need to have to protect and collect revenues. I would ask that you ask these questions and ask the administration to follow the proper process to address the critical issue of being able to attract and retain employees.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan, for raising these questions for us. And we will have those up, and I hope you get also copies of additional letters and studies that were presented in the packet today on answering some of the questions we had last time. Does anyone have a question of Mr. Duncan? Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much for your testimony, which I found to be quite compelling. But we're still left with the short term, or in the immediate term, the problem of not having some of the essential workers that we need. The Pioneer Homes, if they don't have pharmacists, they're in serious trouble. So do you have suggestions for how we can meet the immediate need while other possible fixes are being implemented?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might respond, that is a serious issue, but it's been an issue that's been around for a couple of years, or been longer than that, and clearly we should have been working, and management should have been working on this for some time. Instead, they come in with this legislation this year to try to move these to exempt service. A couple proposals. One is, I think we need to put a new pay plan in place in a collective bargaining agreement. As I said, I'm going to ask management to negotiate that with me, or to go back to the table to agree to do that immediately. That doesn't mean we're going to increase the wages on the present salary schedules, but a pay plan that would give us two or three more ranges to accommodate what management is saying needs to be done. Secondly, then, I think management should go back and review the classes that they're looking at for internal alignment, and I think Mila Cosgrove testified the other day they are putting together proposals so they can do market-based comparisons with the private sector and with jobs outside state government. That should be done immediately. And once that is done, put those folks on the new pay plan, recruit, and fill the positions. It may take two or three months to do that, but it will be quicker than passing a piece of legislation that is flawed and which will be subject to challenge.
Are there any other Thank questions you. For Mr. Duncan? Thank you very much Representative Gardner, follow.
Thank you. I'm looking for even a shorter-term solution. Do you have ideas for what the Pioneer, what we can do to have placed pharmacists in the Pioneer Homes this week or next week? Do you have suggestions?
Representative Gardner, unfortunately, I don't think there's anything you can do this week or next week. And, of course, this legislation won't pass quick enough to do that this week or next week either. So I don't think you're going to be able to find a solution that quickly for this week or next week. But what we're looking for is a solution that could be in place. The effective date of this bill, if it should pass, would be July 1st, 06. So what we should be looking for is a solution that can do it as quick as that, without moving from classified service to exempt service. So, you know, I don't mean to be avoiding your answer, but I don't think there is a solution for this week or next week that would maintain the integrity of our collective bargaining agreement, maintain the integrity of the classified system, and allow those individuals to be placed at a higher pay level as they should be. But it can be done through a proper process as quickly as this legislation can do it, and it can be done by keeping them in classified service if management is willing to work with us to do that.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Duncan. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House Bill 485? Seeing none, we will close public testimony. And we get to have Mila and Janet back.
Who would you like first?
Well, Janet, why don't you come up?
For the record, Janet Clark, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health and Social Services.
Good morning, Janet. There were several different questions that were brought up in testimony, in public testimony you've heard. Do I need to ask each one of those, or can you address those individually?
Mr. Chairman, most of those questions really are for Department of Administration, Division of Personnel. Related to Mr. Duncan's inquiries about management, they're really the experts in the law, the rules, the regulations regarding this situation. You know, I will just say that, you know, we're the operating agency. We're the ones that have brought this problem to you and to the administration with the pharmacists, and we really have a serious life, health, safety issue if we don't have enough pharmacists, and that's what our message really is. I can be here to support Mila, but I think Ms. Cosgrove really is the expert in this area.
Sure. And so your information for us is you want a fix that will put pharmacists in the Pioneer Homes, and whichever fix that the Department of Administration comes up to accomplish that is okay with you.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Based on our discussions with Department of Administration, they basically said this was the fix, that we needed to move them into exempt service. And so that's the approach that we took.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Lynn.
Yes, thank you. I understand there's a serious problem over the Pioneer Home. And I guess an emergency problem. We need some pharmacists over there yesterday. And this bill, whatever form it takes or doesn't take, as somebody said, wouldn't be effective, I think, until July 1st. Since we have a kind of a dangerous situation, or the emergency situation, if you will, why not just outsource temporarily till we get this thing fixed in one way or another? It would be expensive, but not as expensive as losing patients at the Pioneer Home.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, that is what we're doing through temp agencies, et cetera, to fill the gaps. But it's not the best situation because they're not our employees, and you know how that employee-employer relationship, so it is difficult, but we are trying to make do, so that's indeed what we're doing.
Thank you, Janet. Any other questions for Ms. Clark? Reverend Gatto.
Yeah, Janet, outsourcing is $80 an hour or something like that, some number like that?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I think we were paying $70 an hour, yes.
But no benefit package?
Well, again, through the chair, Representative Gatto, we're obviously paying a temp agency. They probably have profit. They probably have benefits.
Well, no, yeah, I understand that. I'm just looking to compare outsourcing at $80 an hour with no benefits versus in-house at 50, 6, whatever our number is, plus benefits. Are we worse off outsourcing on the package?
Representative Gatto, we're currently paying, through the classified system, about $32 an hour. So there is quite a bit of margin. So no.
All right. Thank you.
This is one of those situations where paying a state employee is probably cheaper than outsourcing.
That's fine. We'll get Ms. Cosgrove up. Okay. Is there any further questions for Department of Health and Social Services? None.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning. This is Mila Cosgrove, Director of the Division of Personnel. And I assume you'd like me to just launch into some of the questions that were raised.
If that Yeah, that would be easier than us asking.
Okay, I did not take detailed notes, so I will do my best to answer, but if I've neglected something, please feel free to ask. I guess a couple of points. Mr. Duncan did bring up a number of very good and legitimate points that should be considered by this committee in making this decision. And as I stated on Tuesday, it's not a decision that should be made lightly. The merit system does contemplate classified employment, and that's something that's very, I mean, that's the foundation of our personnel system. I would like to address a couple points, though. First of all, the Personnel Act also clearly contemplates the ability of this body to move people out of the classified service. And in fact, if you take a look at the Personnel Act in 3925.110, there's a whole list of classifications other than exempt level policy and political appointees who have been exempted for a variety of reasons. So this is not without precedent. Second, though Mr. Duncan's offer to negotiate is very nice and well-intended, and we'll certainly consider that, or my counterpart in the Department of Administration will, he's not the sole representative of the pharmacist. In fact, most of the pharmacist positions are in the Alaska Public Employees Association bargaining unit, in the supervisory unit bargaining unit. While we can certainly take a look at raising the pay scales and adding additional ranges, the question still becomes, with these classifications, the pay they're receiving in the market is so high that it becomes difficult to place them at the upper ends of the pay scale. Essentially, you'd be placing them at the same level as commissioners or the governor, and it's there's a process where it's actually more palatable to pay somebody a straight wage versus attach them to a salary schedule, if that makes any sense. And you can see that reflected in other exempt classifications. Mr. Duncan also raised some questions regarding the concept of political spoils and competency. Certainly with the pharmacists, I would argue, they have to be licensed. They're certainly going to be competent. There's no way you can put an unlicensed pharmacist into one of those positions, nor would it behoove management to put an incompetent licensed pharmacist in place. That simply wouldn't do for patient safety. Nor would I argue that they're particularly subject to political pressure. So I think for the pharmacist, that argument does not apply. I would make similar arguments for the corporate income tax auditors, the forensic auditors. Certainly, the department sat here and said they need people who are at the highest level of competency and able to not only perform the work, but also provide the training and knowledge transfer, if you will, to the lower level staff. They're in an untenable position at this point, and they're beyond being able to function effectively in their current capacity. They need additional staff, and they need additional staff now, and they need to have the access to the wages in order to accomplish that goal. Although I understood Mr. Duncan's assertion about perhaps taking the state to court if the legislature made this move, I'm not confident that would be successful. I'm not an attorney, so my opinion shouldn't weigh too much in that. But again, the legislature clearly has the authority to remove people, and the Personnel Act does consider that. And this might be a point of issue for the Department of Health and Social Services. If I may, through the chair, Representative Gatto, you asked a question about contract pharmacists, or perhaps it was Representative Lynn who asked that.
No, we both did.
Yeah, it's my understanding, though I could be incorrect about this, that the state is actually required to employ the chief pharmacist at the Pioneers Home, and that it has to do with their relationship with the Drug Enforcement Agency. So that might be an area that you might want to probe into further, but that is something that we discussed with them, and it's again tied back to the concept of funding and what their requirements are. When you're dealing with a contract agency, you don't have continuity of employees. You ultimately can hold the contracting firm responsible for the individual's performance, but it becomes much more difficult to deal with issues as they arise. And furthermore, it's always a difficult and often unworkable situation when you have contract employees supervising normal state employees, and there are other state employees in the pharmacies, pharmacy techs and lower level people who are working in that agency, and you want a clear line of supervisory authority. And I would gather that the home administrators don't have the time and resources to adequately supervise the lower level staff. With that, I think I have covered the points, but if there are any additional questions, I would be happy to address them.
A couple of just clarifications first. One is the exempt levels are those, I know within some of those categories, people can just be terminated not for cause. Mm-hmm. Within these two categories, would that also be the case so that they can be terminated without cause?
Mr. Chair, there's nothing specific in the State Personnel Act that talks about dismissal for cause or not cause with exempt level employees. And as we discussed on Tuesday, there's two different flavors of exempt level employees, if you will. There's the people who are clearly political employees, such as commissioners, who come and go and purely serve at the will of the governor. For individuals who are not in policy-making positions, I would argue from a legally defensive human resource standpoint that the state would need to have some level of cause to dismiss them from employment. In other words, you would have to prove, you would have to point to some behavior or misconduct or competency in the workplace in order to let them go. Otherwise, the state would be subject to a legal challenge. It's less of a solid ground, perhaps, than what you might observe in a collective bargaining agreement. But nevertheless, that argument is there. And if you look across the nation, there's a majority of employers who have a high degree of their workforce who are technically at will, but they still have to observe the same sorts of processes and solid business practices, or they open themselves up for legal suits. And this legal environment of human resources is becoming more and more contentious in that way. And employers are being held to a higher standard of cause, even for at-will employees.
Okay, and another point that was raised was that the pharmacists under the federal contract or reimbursement contract, they need to be in a merit pay system?
Mr. Duncan raised that point, and I'm not knowledgeable on that point in order to answer your question. That would be a question for the Department of Health and Social Services.
Okay, and Janet, I think, is the department listening? Because we'll pull you back up for a response to that question. We can wait. We'll finish here. But I just wanted you to be aware. Has there been a job description written for this? That was the other question, whether this was really just the same as a tax auditor for, or is this a different job with a job description that is different?
There's two points on that, if I may, Mr. Chair. The pharmacists are clearly performing the duties that are articulated in the class description for pharmacists. So in that case, that is absolutely true. We've done our internal alignment. We've discussed market-based pay, and it's the Division of Personnel's assertion that even given market pay adjustments, we will not be able to adequately get pharmacists to the level that they need to be, and thus our recommendation that they attempt to exempt them from the classified service. Department of Revenue did not come to us directly and say, we want to create a new job class. Instead, what they've done, and we did recently do a classification study of all revenue auditors. Prior to about a year ago, they were all in one job class. We broke them out into distinct job class families, corporate income tax auditors, oil and gas auditors, tax auditors, and did an internal alignment. So in that assertion, they have followed the process. They came to us with the work, we studied it, we did our internal alignment, and we came up with where we believe the salary ranges were appropriate given that internal alignment. It's my understanding that the body of work that they're seeking to exempt is similar to that of the corporate income tax auditor level 4. There may be some additional duties assigned, but it would behoove you to ask that directly of the Department of Revenue. That said, I do know from talking with their division management that the type of work assigned at that highest level takes the highest degree of competency from their auditors, and Division Director Wilson discussed the special sets of skills those people need in order to adequately and competently represent the states in those types of audits. And those are the types of skills and competencies that come at a fairly high level of pay. Again, it's beyond, if we were to take the whole series and adjust them to market, then they would we would be raising their lower levels up to a point where we were the market leader in terms of pay at the lower level. And I don't think that that's good business practice. I think it's better to, in this rare case, to take that isolated group of people and put them in a different class. And for just the information of the committee, we do encourage different exempt titles than classified titles, so we can clearly articulate. So if they tried to name that group of work Corporate Income Tax Auditor 4, we would come to them and say, we would like you to use a different name because this body of work is in the exempt service.
Okay, and is the Department of Revenue here? Yeah, okay, we'll get them up in a minute also. Representative Lynn, did you have a...
No, I did, but I think you addressed the question. And it was, you know, put the auditors into a position that could jeopardize objectivity, but I think you addressed that.
Okay. Does anyone else have a question for personnel? Thanks.
If I may make just one more comment, I provided through your staff a document that Representative Gardner asked for. And again, I'd just like to give this to you with the caveat that this is collected anecdotally. We're in the process of validating this and seeing if there are other job classes where we have recruitment and retention difficulties. And again, underscore the fact that there's a specific way that we will be implementing market-based pay, and it needs to be consistent with that process of internal alignment, and we need to make sure that it's established in a fair and equitable manner. So I just want to make that very clear, and if the committee has any questions about that, I'd be happy to answer those, and then provide you the more detailed data once we have that collected.
Thank you. Yeah, that was one of the letters that I mentioned that we have in our packet, and so we'll study that, and we'll be looking forward to you coming back when they when all that new data is all done. Thank you, Ms. Gardner. Let's see. We had the Department of Revenue. Why don't we start with?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Revenue. And did you have a specific question you wanted me to address?
Yes, I did want you to address the classification and the job description of this forensic auditor position and how that differentiates from Tax Auditor 4.
With the forensic auditor, what we're looking for, and we have not done a formal job description for that position, we probably would do a formal job description after we have further identified even possibly the person who's doing it, so we can identify the job description to their skills to some extent, because we're trying to find people who have very specific knowledge in tax shelters or corporate income apportionment, very, very specific expertise that has to do with corporate income tax returns. And we're talking about people who will be looking at the corporate tax returns for the very largest corporations in the world, actually, and looking at their worldwide income. So we're talking about people who may have a person who specializes in some worldwide apportionment issue on corporate income tax. We may have another person who is specializing in tax shelters. So these will be people that are very focused possibly on individual concerns and training for the people in the department.
Yeah, I'm somewhat troubled, though that's your department, on writing job descriptions after we identify people. So I would suggest that it would help us to have job descriptions broad enough that would allow you to choose among people that have those skills. But I just
in the exempt service, it is very common that the job descriptions are not very specific in terms of the work as a classified system. Are they're vague until they're filled, or they're broad until they're filled, and then you hone in. So because they're not the same type of job descriptions used in the classified system. I would like to speak to the issue, if I may, about the political influence. You know, the Department of Revenue has investment officers and has had investment officers since the 80s who are in the exempt service. The $20+ billion that is invested by the Department of Revenue is handled by exempt employees. And I don't believe that there's any evidence of political influence in our investment policies that has affected people's jobs over the past 15-plus years when they've been in the exempt service. And I think that system has worked very well for the department.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Department of Revenue? Thank you, Chair. And can we have the Department of Health and Social Services?
Mr. Chairman, Janet Clark, the Department of Health and Social Services again. I believe the question that was raised by Mr. Duncan was that there is a federal issue about paying for those individuals in the exempt service. What I'm aware of is that there's a federal rule about the federal government not paying for the executive, the chief executive. For example, in our department, we have a commissioner who oversees many, many federal programs, particularly the Medicaid program. And there is a federal rule that we cannot charge off that salary of the executive, the chief executive, to a federal program because the federal government basically says that exists to run the whole department. That wouldn't be fair. That position exists for a whole lot of other reasons, and so you cannot charge that person directly to a federal program. And that is the only prohibition that I'm aware of as far as federal rules go. We have many employees in the exempt service who are being paid for through federal funds currently and have been for many years, particularly our psychiatrists at API, which are very similar to this situation. They've been in the exempt service for probably 20 years. They may have been some of the first physicians put in the exempt service. And we have other physicians that are also being paid for with federal grants. I think the federal government basically looks at the work they're doing to determine whether they're eligible for a federal reimbursement or not. Are they actually doing a work of a federal grant? And there are other states who get these similar federal grants who have at-will or exempt employees who are not in collective bargaining. So it's not a problem for our department.
Okay, and I would encourage you to go ahead and research that to see if there's any problem just if they're not in a merit pay system, just so that question is fully answered as this bill goes along. But,
and I'll probably ask Mr. Duncan or his representative to give me the regulation he's concerned about.
Sure, and I just appreciate you addressing that. Does anyone have a question for Department of Health and Social Services? Thanks, Jim. So we closed public testimony. Do we have any discussion on the bill? Representative Gatto.
See if I can find it. The number
488 or 485. We better not build the wrong bill. And we do have fiscal notes.
Chair, I'll move House Bill 485 from committee with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and individual. What did I say? Did I get it
you
right?
You did it. Yep.
So these are these long nights we're having.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objection, House Bill 485 will move from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. And now we have before us House Bill 475. And we'll take a brief at ease for just a couple of minutes here.
Mr. Chair, I'll move we adopt CS for House Bill 475, version Y.
So we have before us version Y for House Bill 475 as our working document. Seeing no objection, we have version Y. And I guess I'll pass you the gavel since it's my bill.
Sure.
And
can we hear any comments, Representative Seaton? I'm sure you'd like to tell us a little bit about why there are so many pages to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The House Bill 475 is the technical cleanup bill for Senate Bill 141 last year, the PERS and TERS. There were a number of portions of that bill where there were internal conflicts, things that got changed in the TERS system, that the language didn't get changed in the PERS or the police fire. We also had things where we added on benefits to employees, such as the occupational death and disability that was had never been for teachers or for other PERS members or general PERS members before, which we added into as a benefit. But those things didn't get really clarified, and so there were a number of provisions that needed to be clarified. So what I would like to do is you have for you two things. One is the bill, and I might say that this is the first bill I've ever had that had the title run off of the first page. And that's because that each one of these are a separate item relating to particular items. And please don't talk about reading the title, Mr. Chairman, for introduction.
Trouble reading the bill.
For introduction of it. But I do have my staff here, Katie Schaus, who has been working on this bill, as well as the departments here. But I think that the easiest thing to do might be just to go through the bill itself and talk about those issues and any that we have a flag for or any that we think that are policy calls or anything any policy different than we adopted last year. Let's flag those and then talk about them. And then maybe what we could do is, you know, narrow down the focus of consideration.
And just a comment, there are 18 pages just to the sectional analysis. So this bill may be, when attached to Senate Bill 141, it's going to be a very thick packet. But I think because that legislation was so compelling and so important that maybe it's very good that we have this. So proceed.
Okay, well, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, what I'd do is just start on page 2 and we'll just go right through the changes and then see if any of the committee members have any questions or problems with each one of those. Each one of these sections is basically a separate amendment. There are going to be several that are repetitious where one section deals with police fire where we need to address an issue. Another section will be exactly the same issue with TERS, with teacher retirement system, and another section where it's with the PERS, the general PERS system. So I think it'll get a lot shorter as we go through because if we have a problem with one section, we'll be able to flag two or three at the same time.
And I notice we have some NEA members in the audience. Will you be? I don't have the testifying list, but are you on the list to testify? You are. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you look on page 2, we can see where we have appeals, where we're changing so that the appeals, a member has a final the final decision under AS 4464 is delegated to the administrative law judge and shall be issued within 180 days of the date. The situation here is that 180 days is a reasonable number, reasonable time limit. There has been places where there has been no time limit, and there was also a considerate, I think we had 120 days, which wasn't long enough to get a the full hearing process through. So that's what this is to make sure that we get a full and adequate hearing of the appeal, but we have it constrained in a short enough time so it can be so that the employee has a decision in a relatively short time.
Did this go from 180 days from some other number, or just there was no reference earlier?
In the original, there was no reference, and then I think in the sectional, if you look at the sectional, I believe that we had stated 120 in 141, and it turned out that the 120 days is considered by the administrative section just not to be long enough to get an adequate hearing for the individual.
I got it. Okay.
Are there any questions on?
No, I see it in the section. Okay. Like, you know, just I need some help myself here, but it did go from 120 days to 180.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And I don't see this referenced in the little sponsor statement cheat sheet here. This is that's not one of the things you have enumerated. Or is it?
I'll have to ask my staff person to come up and ask about that one on the appeals. I thought we had the.
Maybe I'm just missing it.
Yeah, there's so many. Maybe we missed that one. Katie, would you?
Is that okay? Yeah, just go ahead. Katie?
For the record, Katie Schaus, staff to Representative Seaton. My apologies. The sponsor statement is very broad because the bill does encompass so many things. The procedure for the office clarifies procedure for an appeal to the Office of Administrative Hearings. It is kind of my bullet point for that category.
Which one, please?
That's the fifth one up from the top.
Fifth up from the top?
From the bottom. Fifth one up from the bottom.
It's very tricky for a morning statement.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Okay.
Section 2 is a new subsection, and it puts the employer contribution rate may not be less than the rate required after subtracting the member contribution rate to fully fund the actuarial contribution benefits expected to be earned by the active members during the fiscal year. That was a consistent policy that we had in 141. That's what we were saying, was you can't contribute less than the and it didn't get done for this one section.
And Katie, just go ahead.
I would like to add that this section 2 has a delayed effect date of 2008, and you'll find that on the last page of the bill. And the reason for that is there are a number of employers whose assets actually exceed their liabilities and need a few years to be able to account for that. So that does have a delayed effective date, and I believe you'll hear testimony to the effect.
Okay. Representative?
So, Mr. Chairman, does anybody have any question on what that is or why that's in there? Okay. Section 3 is membership service for which contributions will be refunded is not credible under the section. In other words, if a person leaves the system, then basically they're not going to be able to reinstate if they take their money and leave the system.
And currently, under old PERS-TERS, I guess we could do that. You could leave the system and then
buy back in.
Right, buy back.
Right. And Miss, direct that to my staff.
I will.
I believe if you refer to the sectional analysis, Section 3 specifically deals with conditional service for TERS membership. And the other issue that Representative Seaton addressed will be dealt with in subsequent sections of the bill. But in the way the bill was written, if a member had any TERS service no matter when mm-hmm. in their past, and then they came back to work for PERS, if they had at least 2 years of TERS service and they had cashed out, they could buy back that service and receive a conditional TERS benefit. This means that in some cases, a PERS employee could still be working, and if they were a Tier 1 TERS employee for those 2 years, could be receiving both a pension and a medical benefit for those 2 years of service. And this only applies to members who had cashed out of TERS and then pay back in. So a member who did not cash out of those 2 years of Tier 1 TERS service and then comes back for another employer would still be eligible for this benefit, conditional service benefit.
I guess I wanted to turn it around. If you, just for understanding, if indeed you worked in TERS and just quit, took your money and left, and here it is 30 years later, and you're going, well, that was a mistake. Can I reverse that? I guess that's the question.
You can until the year 2010, in which case you will not be able to cash back into the system, pay back if you've already cashed out. And the reason for that, and that was incorporated in Senate Bill 141, and we debated it extensively, is because it represents a very large unknown liability to the system.
Correct. Thank you. And
those sections will be addressed specifically in the bill. Subsequent cleanup sections for that concept that was incorporated in the Senate Bill 141.
And Mr. Chairman, if there are further details that you want, we do have retirement benefits here so that they can come up and address those as well. Section 4 of the bill addresses a contribution into a trust account, and what happened is we gave a new benefit to TERS members and to PERS members in 141 that they hadn't had before in the defined benefit system, and that is occupational death and disability. However, the contribution rate or the contributions weren't specified that those went into a trust account. So basically all you had was each employer having a small amount that they were depositing, but no way to pay the benefits because the benefit has to be a system-wide benefit for that amount of money to be able to pay those benefits to the people that are injured or die. Section 5 is dealing with an eligible person shall, when they make irrevocable election at 75, and then it says the administrator may require the eligible person to show that they had medical insurance from that time or that show evidence of insurability. And this was talked about at the time we were doing 141. It didn't get incorporated in the way that the language comes out. So what this is if somebody retires early and decides not to take the medical benefit and pay the premium, and then later at their retirement age wants to be in the medical plan, this prevents it from adverse selection. In other words, people saying, oh, I'm not going to have medical coverage, I'm going to accumulate all my medical problems, and then as soon as I'm in the system, then I'll put it all on the system. So it just demonstrates that a person has either medical insurance coverage from their early retirement until they're eligible for selecting medical retirement under this plan, the retirement plan, or that they at least have a letter of insurability, that they are insured.
That was the next question. As long as they have any current insurance, then they have insurability.
That's correct. It's either that they have been covered by insurance, or that they have a evidence of insurability. Section 6 is if a disabled member becomes eligible for occupational death and disability benefits before the normal retirement age, then what this is saying is that the person is still vesting in their employer contributions and medical benefits. So what it means is that if someone is disabled, the employer is required to continue making payments into their retirement plan and their medical benefits while they're disabled. Otherwise, what would happen is there wouldn't be contributions being made into their defined contribution plan or their medical benefits.
And I guess what you're saying is they're paying the employee's portion or just the employer's portion?
I believe it's the employer's portion. They are receiving their benefits under, as a disabled member, but this requires the employer to continue to make the employer's contributions.
And Katie, do you have any idea what would happen at that point? I mean, it sounds like home insurance, where if you get sick and you can't make your house payments, that you have insurance where the insurer will make your house payments for you. But here we have two people making the payments, both the state and the individual. And so in that event, the individual's contributions, assuming they're run out of sick leave or whatever leave they run out of, those payments will continue to be paid?
How I understand this section is that...
Mr. Chairman.
We'll get to it, right.
Yeah. And I want to draw your attention to the sectional analysis, because I was mistaken. The last line is, the employer must also make the member's contributions to the individual contribution account.
Thank you. There it is, right at the bottom of page two. Okay.
There are a number, Mr. Chairman, there are a number of sections here that deal with requiring the employer to carry the and make the contributions for either a person that dies to their account, so it'll be available for their spouse at normal retirement age, or for making medical payments on the disabled person's behalf. Mm-hmm.
It is important, though, you know, when I read it in the sectional, I want to make sure that I also read it in the bill itself. The sectional is to clarify the bill, and I think the intent is certainly there, but at least we have it on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 7 is a monthly amount. Here we are on occupational death and disability, or disability benefit of 40% of the gross monthly compensation at the time, and a member is not entitled to elect distribution from the member's individual contribution account while the member is receiving disability benefits under this section. And to clarify that is that what we're doing is we're requiring that the employer continue to make deposits for the employee into their defined contribution account. However, at some point when a person has service, they would be able to start taking their retirement benefits out, and then they wouldn't be there for them when they retire. So this is clarifying that we're requiring the employer to make those contributions so that they will be there for retirement, and that it's not a, as you're going along and receiving your disability payments, you could also drain out your retirement plan and then it wouldn't be there for you. Section 8, again, it's amending a disabled member's occupation disability benefit terminates the last day of the month following the date when he qualifies for normal retirement, and at that time the member's benefit shall be determined. And a member whose occupational disability benefit terminates under this subject shall be considered to have retired directly from the plan. There's a couple of things. First of all, this is trying to administratively determine, okay, we know when a person goes into retirement. And also there's a section that to get benefits under medical benefits, you must retire directly from the plan. So this determines that a person can be eligible at the, even if it's early retirement date, even if it had, you know, you've accumulated that 30 years of service as a disabled person, but that you are you're being considered as retiring directly from the plan, which gives you access to the medical plan. Section 9 is a long one here. Again, it's setting out under for death and disabled member retiring the date at which that's going to happen. And you see the spouse or dependent child there. The original language left out the word dependent child, which is in the IRS code defining what a child is, and again, setting out the time, the date at which the retirement comes in.
All right.
Section 10 is the same thing as far as payments, and this is for a surviving spouse or a dependent child, and when they when they're receiving those. And again, it's for normal retirement if the member had survived, and whichever date is sooner.
Okay.
Section 11, again, we're in survivor's benefits for, you know, it's a 40% monthly compensation in the survivor. Again, this is under a different section, isn't it? You can't take and drain your retirement account that we're trying to have built up for you by making the employer make the contributions while you're receiving the benefits, the survivor's benefits.
All right.
Section 12 is, again, we're talking about survivor's benefits here. Better get over to the... Katie, you want to go through this one?
In Section 12?
Yes.
This just clarifies that the period of death benefits that references sexual analysis constitutes membership service for determining vesting in medical benefits and health reimbursement arrangement. Similar language was you just reviewed for the pension section. This is for the medical section.
And again, Mr. Chairman, the intent of this section is to make sure that people qualify for benefits under the plan. Section 13 clarifies that membership in the BB plan. This is clarified that transferring the membership, so I think we need to look at this. Upon transfer, all membership service previously earned under a DB plan shall be nullified for the purpose of entitlement to the future benefit under the benefit plan, but shall be credited for the purpose of determining vesting in the employer contributions. One thing that happened was we were allowing people to transfer from the DB plan, a voluntary basis only, mm-hmm. of course, to a DC plan, but we didn't have it specified in there that the number of years that you had in your DB plan would qualify for you vesting in your DC plan. So this says that if you were serving 2 years in a DB plan, not only did the money transfer over, but the years of service count for your vesting.
Yeah, I was having trouble reading that into the statement, but once again, it's on the record, so.
And Section 14 provides a time limit here. A member who is eligible to elect transfer, again, this is voluntary transfer from the DB plan to the DC plan, who is eligible to transfer to the defined contribution plan must make the election not later than 12 months after the member's employer notifies the administrator that the member's employer consents to the transfer of his member. And that's a long-winded way of saying that what happens is the employer can look at his range of employees, and the employer has to make a selection and say, I will allow any member who wishes to transfer that's non-vested from the DB plan into the DC plan. However, that comes with a liability because Senate Bill 141 said that for that to happen, you have to leave your money that you originally contributed into the DB plan there, and you have to make a payment into the DC plan for those years of service. So it's a liability onto the employer, and we're wanting to let them and the employees make that selection. But if there's not a window of of time in which you can say, what range of employees do I have that could select that? It would be open-ended so that 10 years or 15 years in the future, just whoever came on board would be able to select that that option and give you as a municipality or a school district a large liability, and it would be an unknown liability. And therefore, what would happen is that we would have probably very few employers that would give their employees the option of converting. And so this is a way that they can look at the employee base and say, how much is it going to cost us? What's our range of employees that could take, mm-hmm. that aren't vested, that could take this provision, advantage of this provision, and we'll offer that to them. But without this provision in there, very few people will offer that alternative because it would be an open-ended thing from then until the end of time. And so this allows the 12 months after the employer says, okay, any employee that wants to convert from DB to DC that's not vested, you have the next year to do it, and they'll be able to analyze their base.
We've used DC so much, and now I see DCR, Defined Contribution Retirement. Is there a distinction between the two?
No, there is no distinction. It refers to a defined contribution retirement, defined contribution plan.
Okay, so we've just been using an abbreviated way to talk about it. Thank you.
Let's see, and that was section
14
and 15. Just specifies the dates in which that 12 month conversion takes place. And then it also allows the employer the additional time so that they can, in the future, give employees another 12-month window.
And when we talk about a 12-month window in retirement, we're always saying the last day of the month at your eligibility. Would that apply also for this window, that the window is open? The first day of the window opens when you say it does, but actually the clock starts ticking on the last day of the month and then moves forward for 12 months, or are we going date certain to date certain?
The initial period during which the employer's member may choose commences on the first day of the month following the administrator's receipt of notice.
So
it's a time certain, and it goes for 12 months from the first day of the month,
following month,
and for 12 months, and then again, you know, that closes the window, and they can do that based on their financial analysis of their spread of employees, and then at a future time, if they have additional employees that have hired on that would like to take advantage of the conversion, and if they, under their analysis, say that fiscally, since they're going to have to make these additional deposits, they could open that window again one more time for an additional 12 months. And just so the committee understands the financial liability, if you had no windows in here, the reason why, let's say, school districts would not take and make this available to their employees is you might do open this up, and then 12 years later, you have an employee that you hire that's got 7 years of service someplace else. And you've hired them, and since there was no window, they could say, oh, I want to convert, and convert, because they're not vested, as it's an 8-year vesting in TERS, and that school district would be forced to make all of those contributions for 7 years that were in a different part of the system into an individual account for that person. It would be a huge liability, and there would be no way to know what those factors are, because it's illegal to hire people or not hire people based on their retirement status in the retirement. Section 16, Mr. Chairman, is add the definition of membership service here for clarifying what service is eligible for credit for transfer again. Katie, do you have any further explanation on that one?
Sure. Basically, Section 16 just clarifies that when a member is paying off indebted service, that service doesn't count for their transfer, both dollar amount and years, until that service is paid out. Therefore, let's say you cashed up for 5 years, you've been back, or for let's do 3 years. And you've paid back two of those years, and you still haven't paid back the third year. When you elect to transfer, the third year would not be credited to your account, both in years of service and membership, until that third year was paid back to the system.
All right. Okay. And let's see, Section 17 is just making sure that, I mean, we had an incorrect definition here, because policies are adopted by the commissioner. They're not adopted by the ARM board. That's on page 8 of the bill. Again, Section 18 does the same thing. This is actually a duty of the commissioner, not a duty of the board.
Right.
Section 19, we're talking about appeals. And again, it's 180 days. Section 20 is, again, dealing with the same thing on appeals that we dealt with before. Section 21 is dealing with contributions. And that, let me see. Let me take a little more look at that.
Yeah, Representative Gardner, we're going over the bill relative to the sectional analysis, okay, relative to the comments of the sponsor.
Thank you.
And Section 21 takes it back to what we were actually doing in the decisions that were made in 141, and that the defined contribution from an employer to the HRA is all participants in the plan. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what this is, and this was talked about in our committee as well as all across, is that the HRA contribution is the average of all the people across the system. In the last drafting, it went from system to plan, so it appeared that it was every individual employer had their wage base, and that's really not IRS compliant, as we were told in this committee as well as throughout the process. It was the HRA contribution will be based on the average wage of all the employees, not just a single employer. Section 22 removes a conflict between eligibility for retirement and medical benefits and the HRA plan. The Section 23.
Let's go back to 22.
Yeah.
When we first saw the title, termination of employment, I think it's going to be an important one. Loses any right to the contributions made on behalf of the person to the teachers and public, et cetera. And then there's some specific dates in there, December 31st of the year when they reach 65 years old. Can you just elaborate one more time on the significance of Section 22?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, one thing that we did specify, and this came out in this was in conference committee, and what happened was there was a real dispute as to how long a person's HRA would be available to them and whether it would terminate if they didn't vest immediately, and the House was very explicit that we felt that an HRA contribution was just like a the defined contribution retirement portion, and that that should be kept on the books for the person, and that if as long as they came back in service before they were 65 years of age, that those years of service and that amount would be held for them in their HRA account, and they didn't lose it. They would pick up their HRA account just as if they hadn't left service at all.
Thank you.
Section 23. This is just saying that either you're under TERS or PERS, you're eligible. You don't have to be in both. That was just there was no intention to say you had to be both a PERS member and a TERS member to be eligible under the plan. Section 24 is again the 180 days on appeal time. Section 25 is
just yes. One more thing. The term 180 days, I've heard it come in conflict earlier times. We mean calendar days, do we mean work days? I think typically we know in our heads what it means, 6 months' time, but for clarification, it's often a good idea to put calendar days in, and then you're recognizing also that February is a short month. You could reach the 6 months and have 181 days or some other number besides an exact number, 180 days. So if we clarify 180 calendar days, then I think that might be helpful.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, maybe we could get the retirement benefits or law to do they have any to find out whether they had any?
If that's in statute,
if it's already
definition
in statute
of 180 days. Yeah. Representative Rammers, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I do not.
Okay. Thank you. Moving on.
If we could just flag that for now, and we'll get back with you, Mr. Chairman, on that. Section 25, again, employer contribution rates. This identifies the other section. Remember, we have TERS, we have PERS, and we have police, fire, and so we'll have this in three different sections. And this allows for this to be having a delayed effective date,
okay. So
that those plans that are overfunded, and there are some that are overfunded, will be able to reduce that overfunding. They can never reduce it below 100%. But there are some that are significantly overfunded, and instead of having them make higher contribution rate payments while they're at these large overfunded rates, this allows them to have a couple of years to reduce that amount of overfund.
Okay.
Section 25 is again about the Katie?
Section 25 is the same thing for PERS as for TERS, which repeals the, it says that an employer may not contribute less than the normal cost.
I'm sorry, we're on
Section 25.
26.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just stated.
I was saying we were repeating ourselves.
Okay. I caught myself up again, Mr. Chairman. This is the same. This is the same as that. We're on Section 26, Mr. Chairman, and Section 26 is again this. Dual service or the public service benefit if you're Section 27 removes the provision that allow employees to repay refunded contributions for the purpose of this, again, conditional benefit. Section 28 adds a provision that the administrative hearing of the commissioner decisions on waiver request under PERS. So if you look in the sectional, you'll find that if the amendment is not made, PERS appeals from the commissioner's waivers will have to be sent directly to Superior Court instead of to the administrative hearing procedures, which we established throughout the bill, and this is just one that wasn't caught. So Section 29 is, again, this is the commissioner or commissioner's designee. And Section 30 is, again, talking about a trust account, so that there will be money to pay those disabled benefits under the police fire. Section 31 is, again, just the notice of insurability, or that you had coverage if you had early retirement. Section 32, again, we're talking about the same clarification of disability benefits that include the HRA, so that you do have the HRA benefits are provided. Section 33, that you can't, again, take distributions while you're receiving those benefits and eliminate your, basically, your retirement account. Section 34 clarifies that termination of disability benefits happens when you're able, when you're eligible for retirement.
Okay.
And Section 35 is, again, same thing under police fire, that you can't take your retirement while you're getting your benefits and eliminate your account. Section 36 changes the survivor benefits the same as we did before. Section 37 is, again, survivor's benefit, just as we did in the earlier plan. These are, again, conforming to the other. 38 is, again, survivor.
I'm going to ask Katie a question on survivor's benefits. If a person in any of the plans, PERS, TERS, or police fire, has a retirement benefit of exactly $3,000 a month, and they pass away, their surviving spouse, under some conditions, could get less than $3,000 a month, or is it fixed that your surviving spouse will always get the same amount of money that you are getting?
Colorado, I believe that the pension benefit for the survivor is 40% of salary, and that is adjusted for COLA and PRPA. So, and that under this plan, I know there has been some discussion of that. So, I would anticipate that the benefit would increase with inflation. Welcome to call Melanie Milhorn up for more specifics on the current plan.
Yeah, and I think I understand what you're saying. I just would like to see something in here where a surviving spouse would never get less than the same amount of money as if the deceased spouse were still present. And I'm not sure that in the plans that's always permitted.
Mr. Chairman, if we could get retirement benefits up, they could probably answer the question for us.
Okay. I just want to kind of tip on, place a little mental note on that one, because I think I can demonstrate a situation where that does occur. And so I think now that we have this in front of us, it might be a great place to a simple statement if that's the will of the committee. So I'd like to be able to address that later on, and I'm just hopeful we can just keep it in front of us.
And Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, the question is, would the surviving spouse's benefit be at least equivalent to the person who died benefit.
That's exactly correct.
And we'll get that answer for you. Section 39 is again clarifies that the period of death constitutes membership for service. In other words, when a person is working and they die, the employer will continue to make contributions on the member's behalf until the normal retirement age. Section 40, again, we're talking about transfer membership from the DB plan to the defined contribution plan, and that your years will vet, will count for vesting. Section 41, again, is the 12-month window. Section 42 is the 12-month, the second 12-month window, and when that occurs. Yeah, and that gives them an additional under this plan as well. Section 43 is definition of the membership service, clarifying that a credit is eligible for transfer and when. Section 44 clarifies that member and employee mean the same thing in the bill, because it's been used basically in several ways. And also it goes into that the Department of Education and Early Development positions that require a teaching certificate. So that if you're a teacher and you're, just like we did with the AvTech in Seward, if you the position requires a teaching certificate, then you would be in TERS, otherwise it would be in PERS.
Could you repeat that, please?
If somebody's employed by the Department of Education and their position requires a teaching certificate, then they'd be interred in the teacher retirement system. If their position does not require a teaching certificate, then they would be in PERS, in the public employees retirement system. And that's what we also did for the Department of Labor, where we took, there were positions such as AvTech, which is the Alaska Vocational Technical Center in Seward, and there are people that are vocational instructors there. If their position requires a teaching certificate, then they'll be in the TERS system. If their position does not require a teaching certificate, then they're in the PERS system, the public employees system.
Question on that, because I know my wife is a school nurse, and she's a certified employee, and under this, I think that might defer her to a different group, because I don't think she's certified to teach, but she's nonetheless the school nurse in the building and is the certified employee. So while it's an individual case, I'm sure it expands across the spectrum, and I would like to clarify what the intent is by the definition of, do we mean certified to be in the classroom? Because school nurses are in the classroom probably every day and give classes to children, but they don't have a teaching certificate. And so I want to make it clear what we want to do under these circumstances. Because there are a few people that are always outside the the teaching certificate, but which nonetheless are certified employees.
Mr. Chairman, these are two different words, two different uses of the word certified. A certificated employee requires a teaching certificate would be in the teacher's retirement system. Someone that doesn't have a teaching certificate and their position does not require a teaching certificate would be in the public employee's retirement system. and we get retirement benefits up here, but I'm pretty sure that the nurses are in PERS. No?
No, they're in TERS.
They're in TERS.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
so
it varies? Okay. So it's something when we get...
Sure. We'll flag this one.
We'll flag this one, too.
Yeah. Section 45 is...
Village public safety.
Yeah, it defines who police, fire, and firefighters are. And are not.
Yeah, on that one, too, it very clearly defines who is and then chooses just one member who is not. And I'm just curious about how expansive that definition of who is not is, because as soon as we establish the one group that is not, are we saying... Well, I'm not sure what we're saying. I guess that's the difficulty I have there. If we define who is, does that, and I will try to get legal on it, does that automatically exclude Village Public Safety Officer Program under that statute? Rather than saying it and picking one program, should we expand that to mean all others are not qualified, including this group?
Sure. And
it's a cleanup for me.
Mr. Chairman, we'll flag that, and we'll get retirement benefits up here and find out what the legal way of doing that is. Section 46 is, again, appeals within the 180 days. Section 47 is... the new paragraph. That's it. I think we. Katie, do you have that?
Section 47.
Yeah.
This gives authority jurisdiction to the Office of Administrative Hearings for SBS, the health reimbursement arrangement plan, at deferred compensation, and waivers of adjustment under PERS and TERS.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, if you look at the sectional there, mm-hmm. that this is to give the statutory authority for appeals delegated under these programs to the appealing officers. And Section 48 is repeals the requirement in SB 141 that the employer contribution rate must not be less than the normal rate. And this, Mr. Chairman, dovetails in with the delayed effective dates of the other provisions that requires that take place, that they can't be less.
Right.
But those will be a delayed effective date. Let's see. Section 48. Then repeals the participation of NEA in the TERS system. And if you'll look at the sectional, the reason that they were included way back when, but they haven't been for the other than the grandfathered people that were grandfathered under the previous that were in TERS. Now they're not in TERS, and this just continues the current arrangement, but they're not in TERS.
Would you please explain that again? Under the old system?
Yeah. But
under the defined benefits of the situation?
Under the pre-1990s, they were in TERS, and then there was negotiations with NEA so that they were no longer there. Let me just read it for you. It may be simpler. Although NEA has been included by the legislator in the TERS DB plan and statute, NEA is a nonprofit organization and they do not qualify for inclusion in the system. This error was acknowledged by retirement and benefits in the Department of Law and the NEA in the late 80s, early 90s. In discussion with participating NEA management, it was decided that TERS board and members participating at the time would be grandfathered, and inclusion of new members would be discontinued. Since then, the last member has retired. The inclusion in the new plan resulted from duplication of existing statutes. So what we're doing is they haven't been included in the plan since the early 90s.
They have no members.
Yeah, and when SB 141 came along, it included some old language, and this just gets rid of the old language. It doesn't apply. And Section 48 repeals duplicative language. Section 49 relates to reinstating service associated with refunded contributions, and I think that we talked about that earlier. Yeah, this is the when that those contributions, you have to refund your contributions by 2010 to be there. And Section 50 is this uncodified law, which the first valuation years that they'll be enrolled in the defined contribution plan begins July 1st, 2006, and the contribution rates will be determined cost during 2007 valuation year. So it's a let's see. Yeah, so it just allows us to set the contribution rates because the ARM board hasn't calculated them yet. And then Section 51 is the delayed effective date to 2008 of those three sections that allow people to pay less than the normal cost rate if their systems are overfunded, to allow them to take some of that excess money out that they've got in there. But again, it can't go less than 100%. And the other one, Section 52, is that delayed effective date of 2010, by which you must elect to do your buyback of your reinstatement of for previous service. And then Section 53 is necessary because the effective date no longer applies all provisions of the bill. It only with the, because we have two exceptions, Section 51 and 52.
Well, that was exhausting. thank you, Representative Seaton. Representative Lynn has a question. I hope he directs it to you rather than me.
On the sponsor statement, fourth from the bottom, establishes provisions for employer termination from the plan. Would you explain that and tell me which ones of these sections? I must have missed it. Which one of the 53 sections does that apply to?
Katie? Through Chair, Representative Lynn, that applies to an amendment that we will have before the committee as soon as possible. You're correct. It is not included in this section. It turns out that establishing termination for employers in the plan is a very complex concept and will need the discussion of the committee. So the chair has decided to introduce it as a separate amendment so that it could get ample discussion.
Would you just, if I may, just give me the flavor of it without the technicality? What's your intent?
Sure. Right now, in the defined benefit plan, if an employer chooses that they no longer wish to participate in the plan, they don't need it, they can't afford it, they have another retirement plan.
The employer.
Then they make send a letter to retirement benefits and request termination of the plan, at which point retirement and benefits hires an actuary, consults their actuary to calculate the indebtedness of that employer, their unfunded liability, and they would be required to make the payment of that unfunded liability, and then they would no longer terminate, they would no longer participate in the plan, no longer be required to make payments, and their members who were currently in the plan or were previously in the plan would be considered PERS members and would have those the PERS benefits. And as I understand it, if an employer decides to terminate, all the employers are considered vested in that plan at the point of termination. That's the process right now from terminating. We need to establish a similar process for the defined contribution plan. And because it's different, and there aren't the same liabilities, future liabilities, or unfunded liabilities associated with it. That process is being discussed, and we'll need some decisions from you as a committee.
Thank you.
Has that ever been executed? And I really mean that term exactly. Has a person ever decided to get out of DB and file an application and been able to say, here's some money, and effectively say, we're done?
Certainly, employers have the decision, not individuals. I think the case that I am most aware of is St. Mary. They applied to terminate from the plan, got a very large check and a very large bill that they are now dealing with, but okay. It does happen.
I'm glad we'll have an opportunity to discuss this. It's going to be exciting.
And Mr. Chairman, there were a number of cities that were trying to figure out how to do that, and that's been one of the stimulations behind
the whole. Any more questions? With that, I'll open it up to public testimony. In front of us, Bill Bjork. And we'll need your affiliation.
Chair Gatto, members of the House State Affairs, my name is Bill Bjork. I'm the president of NEA Alaska. NEA Alaska represents over 11,400 active school employees, both teachers and education support professionals, and over 1,300 retired employees. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 475. I can't, however, avoid the temptation to say, I told you so. Last year, I urged this committee to take its time, examine the retirement issues, and consider House Bill 238 as you were drafting it last year, and also the ramifications of Senate Bill 141. In fact, NEA Alaska specifically encouraged the committee to use the interim to study.
Mr. Bjork, I'm going to interrupt you a second here. I hope you're going to move quickly into a discussion of this bill.
I am on 475, sir.
Well, it sounds like you're wavering back to 141.
Well, okay.
And I really want to, you know, 141 is not before us. It is a matter of law now, and I'd like to address what this bill does. And I know it affects 141, but the benefits or consequences or opinions about 141 should not be a part of the discussion of this bill. I want to remain focused on this bill in front of
us.
Well,
as you move, Representative Gatto, towards actually creating a bill that can work for Alaska, you have a whole list of amendments before you, and you have some amendments coming that are pretty substantial that haven't even been drafted yet. These profoundly impact the performance of Senate Bill 141. I absolutely concur that it is not on the table today, but how Senate Bill 141 is actually implemented is absolutely on the table, it appears, particularly with the scope of the amendments that are here in this technical bill.
Okay.
I shall confine myself to the House Bill 475.
And I understand they're connected, and I'll allow certainly some leeway, and I kind of want you to never use the word 141, but I do want your testimony about this bill to focus on this bill.
And I shall try to do my best. Thank you, sir. We specifically encouraged the committee to use the interim to study the issues, and virtually many of those issues are before you today. Today we're looking at House Bill 475, which is a technical cleanup bill to Senate Bill 141. We urge you to set aside 475 and in its place introduce a companion bill to Senate Bill 293, which would delay the implementation of Senate Bill 141 until July 1st, 2008. According to the sponsor statement for 475, a handful of errors and oversights were made that needed to be changed for a smooth transition. Now, my hand could hold four or five items, but not the 13 bulleted items that actually make many amendments to the law. If this is the number of changes proffered now, what might be the number discovered with further study? In fact, no one is sure that the present plan, even with the changes required prior to July 1st, 2006, will meet the compliance regulation of federal law. In fact, several folks who understand federal ERISA regulations, Internal Revenue Service Code, believe the basis of the health reserve account contribution has to be changed, as you have in issue 21, to the average compensation for all plan participation. Thus, I repeat our request that you set aside 475 and in its place delay the implementation of Senate Bill 141 until July 1st.
In this case, it's okay. You know, you definitely wanted to refer to Senate Bill 293, but go ahead. You're only going to mention it three times, so go ahead and use it.
Well, you know, to a fault, I've been teaching for 34 years, and one thing I learned is multiple repetitions are necessary sometimes. Thank you, sir.
But I think I get the point that you want to substitute something for this bill. Basically,
yes,
your conversation on this bill is set it aside and...
Well, then let's do it right.
Something else.
Yeah, I mean, there are tremendous amendments out there yet, sir. Your point is well taken. Last session in Yale, last year, urged you to consider the impact on the present retirement plans if the plans are closed and thus payroll-based contributions are reduced. You assured us that there was no impact. But today we've learned that, in fact, there is. We know employer rates for past service costs will continue to rise as amortized liability is applied to a shrinking payroll paid to members in the defined benefit plans. Thus, not only did Senate Bill 141 not address the liability of retirement plans, it increased the liability for employers. Are you sure that the proposed change will not lead to still greater problems? Do you have the actuarial data to make this determination? NEALASCA believes that the answer to both of those questions are no. Thus, you know, I ask you again, set aside 475 and in its place, introduce a companion bill that would delay the implementation of 141 until July 1st, 2008. NEALASCA believes that the $5.7 billion liability of the present plan is not growing as fast as it was projected to grow last session. One reason is larger than expected investment return. We're also waiting for the actuarial reports to the Alaska Retirement Management Board to determine whether or not Mercer's assumptions were appropriate given the Alaska experience. It seems inappropriate to act until we hear from the folks that Senate Bill 141 authorized to make these recommendations to you. As the committee knows from NEALASCA's testimony last year, we believe a defined benefits plan is far superior to defined contribution plans for retirement purposes for public employees. We understand the concerns, the bona fide concerns of the entire legislature, that predictability of costs and the limitation of liability must be primary components of such a new plan. NEALASCA believes that a defined benefits plan can be fashioned on a set contribution from the employer and the employee, and the legislature really ought to have the opportunity to choose between a DC plan and such a plan as I've described. Last year's forced choice was just not good public policy from our perspective. I repeat our request. Please set aside 475 and in its place introduce a companion bill to Senate Bill 293, which should delay the implementation of Senate Bill 141 until July 1st, 2008, so we have the opportunity to do this right. Thank you, sir.
And thank you for keeping your testimony well condensed to a page and a half. I appreciate that. So, members of the committee, question for Representative Lynn.
I haven't had a chance to go to bases yet, but who sponsored SB
293. Senator Kim Elton.
Thank you.
Okay. Any more questions? No. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll go to Marion Taylor.
Yeah, on arrival. I don't think she intended to sign up the testimony.
I don't have a yes. I don't have any comment in front of her name. So we also have Marion Taylor. Are you here?
She's not.
Not here. Is Karen Eddy here? Neither. Okay, I just want to make sure because there isn't any mark about yes or no. Christina Torquist? Okay, so we'll go to Glenn Ramos, but we have Kathy White Murphy written right after his name. So are you speaking on his behalf, Kathy, or on your own behalf?
That's just, I thought that was a sign-up sheet for president. I don't care.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
I would support what President Bjork just presented to the board.
Do you want to come up front and give your name and at least put that on the record? Give us so that we get your name and certainly your affiliation.
Glenn Ramos, NEA Alaska. And I, too, would support what President Bjork just presented this board. I think that there's a lot of unanswered questions and that you folks need the benefit of the time to take a look at the data that is out there and the possibility of meeting the goal of the original bill, which was to address the liabilities that are out there. Right now, the administration has pointed out that you may have indeed increased your liability, and I think that this committee and the state deserves an opportunity to answer that question and to look at some viable solutions.
Okay. Representative Lynn?
What is your position in the NEA?
I'm a school psychologist in the MATSU. I am a vice president of the local, and I'm an NEA board member.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ramirez?
Thank you. I'd just like to point out to you that part of the reason why we may be facing a potential increased liability is that the House members, under great due rest during a very long and tenuous special session, went to the mat to increase the state retirement contribution by 2 full percentage points over the original intent of SB 141, and that as we go forward, we're going to find that that extra 2% contributes mightily to the accrued retirement benefits under this program. For as long as the state transitions to a defined contribution plan, there will be more state resources that are going into the retirement accounts of NEA members and members of the TERS retirement system. And I just want to make sure that you're aware of the changes that the House pushed into the final conference committee version of that bill. Are you aware of that, sir?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ramirez. Any further questions? I only have one other name, and it's written on the back, Gerald. Anyway, Tennyson? Not here either.
There's somebody standing
up. That's Kathy. Did you want to speak, Kathy?
Yes.
Come forward, please.
Good morning, Representative Gatto, Chair and committee members. I'm Kathy White Murphy. I'm a teacher, a special ed teacher in the Matsu Valley. I've been teaching in the Valley for 20 years. I've been a teacher for 27. I am on the NEA board in Washington, D.C., and by virtue of that position, I serve on the NEA Alaska board. I, too, urge you to set aside this bill. I really appreciate your comments, Representative Gatto, in the complexity of Senate Bill 141 as well as 475. It is apparent to me as you made comments about the lengthiness of this bill and the number of amendments and sections and many more to come, that this is a very complex issue. And last year, as well as I and thousands of other members and communities, were concerned about how rushed the process was. It's extremely difficult to understand, even from people that are very well educated. I would urge you to postpone the implementation of Senate Bill 141 till 2008, so that there can be further studies, so that we can make sure that we have an effective retirement system for future employees in Alaska. It is essential for recruitment. It is essential for retainment. And I would really like you to address these issues in a timely and thoughtful manner. Thank you very much.
Okay, you asked us to set aside 141. Before us is House Bill 475,
correct,
which would clarify a great deal of clarification for 141. Would you rather we did not clarify 141 and simply work to set it aside, or do you think this is a benefit that we should pass and
I would like
another issue later?
Representative Gatto, I would appreciate the committee to allow more studies, more actuarial studies, and look at the details of the defined contribution plan in the tiered systems to make sure that it is being implemented correctly. I don't want to see another rush through of a very complex issue as occurred last session. So, I mean, it is a very complex issue, and it was introduced in mid-March, and even though it extended into the extension of the session, it still is a very complex issue and needs more time. So I would really urge the body to postpone the implementation of 141.
I just want to get back to 475.
475.
You want to
well, then I would like to seek a substitute that would be a companion bill to the Senate bill that is already introduced.
All right. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
With that, Representative Gardner has a question for you.
I'm still a little bit unclear. I agree with NEA Alaska's position on Senate Bill 141. And as you probably know, the House tried to postpone implementation, and certainly I would support that effort again. But in the event that that effort doesn't happen,
right,
and the fact that Senate Bill 141 is now law, would you support 475 or not?
Well, since I just read it this morning, and listening to the testimony in the hearing, I would probably need to look over it more thoroughly. Okay. And I know that this is new in the process, and I'm sure that there will be other sections and amendments that will come forth. So at this time, I cannot state definitively if I would support it or not.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
and thank you. And I would hope that you and other members of the public would look at the individual, not look at this as an entire bill.
Mm-hmm.
This is a whole series of different changes, cleanups, clarifications, and if you would look at those impacts, we'd really appreciate it, because this is not a bill where you have to, you know, either support the bill or oppose the bill. But if you could give us your technical read from your expertise of whether it's a good cleanup to have contributions, you know, so that the employer is required to continue making contributions to your employees while, if somebody becomes disabled, if that's a good thing, then we ought to include it in the bill. If you disagree with that and think that people should not have, the employer shouldn't be required to make those contributions throughout the would have been employment history while somebody disabled or dies, those would be valuable things for us to know. So like I say, I'm not asking anyone to come out and support the entire bill, because the entire bill is a bunch of pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And we need your expertise and your testimony on those pieces and whether those are good things from your perspective representing employees, or whether those pieces are not good.
And absolutely. I do appreciate you looking and revisiting Senate Bill 141 and looking at the issues that were not addressed in Senate Bill 141 that impact future employees. So I appreciate that, and I'm sure NEA Alaska will assist you in giving you recommendations.
Great.
So.
And Mr. Chairman, one other portion of the bill which is interesting is the 12-month window for an employer to set, which is, wasn't a consideration in our original bill, but what it does is it allows employers to offer that to employees. There may be some question as whether that wants, whether the employee base wants to have that option given to their employees. So I would like you to take a look at that one especially also, because it's something that we're trying to clarify so that employers will be able to offer something to employees that they wouldn't probably get offered, but it also does have a window of time. And so we really appreciate getting your feedback on that provision.
We certainly will. Thank you.
No more questions. With that, and the sponsor has asked that we hold this bill over, which I will do, and I will reacquire my position as vice chair and return the gavel to Chair Seaton.
Thank you. I would just urge the public to get and analyze all the provisions of that and get back to us in the future. So we are now on to House Bill, or House Joint Resolution 25.
Let's see if I got the time.
And House Joint Resolution 25, urging the United States Congress to adopt the United States House of Representatives version of the Tax Relief Extension Reconciliation Act of 2005, including Section 303. And the sponsor of that is Representative Kartula. And
sponsorless.
Representative Kartula or her staff here?
Ah. I was stuck trying to get in, everybody's getting out.
That's like a salmon.
Yeah.
Up against the tide.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Hannah McCarty, and I'm staffed Representative Kartula, and she sends her apologies for not being able to attend today. And I just wanted to kind of briefly go over the bill, if that's all right, the resolution, and tell you what it's about. Alaska is one of five states that participates in a veterans home ownership program, and this program makes low interest home loans available to veterans who served before 1977. And currently in the U.S. Congress, there was an American Veterans Home Ownership Act which repealed the pre-1977 service requirement. And that would allow all Alaska State veterans to apply for the home ownership loans. And they have stuck that American Veterans Home Ownership Act into the tax reconciliation bill. And they stuck the language in the House of Representatives version of the tax reconciliation bill. But the U.S. Senate version doesn't have this language. So our resolution urges Congress to approve the U.S. House of Representatives version that contains the Veterans Home Ownership element, and this element would allow all veterans, not just those that served before 1977, to apply for the special veterans homeownership loans. And I do have Brian Butcher here from Alaska Housing Finance to explain the loan program if you guys have any questions. And then I also do have a veteran here who would like to testify in support.
Ms. McCarty, I do have a question, and that
yes.
is that at least in the title here, what we're doing is we're urging Congress to adopt the House's version of the Act, of the entire Reconciliation Act, including Section 303. And personally, I don't know enough about the entire version of the House of Representatives version of the Reconciliation Act to ask mm-hmm. them to accept that entire version. Is the purpose of this to really have us urge adoption of Section 303 of the Tax
Reconciliation Act? Chairman, I believe the language in the title should possibly be altered, because the actual resolution language just requests that we include Section 303 in the Tax Reconciliation Act. So I think maybe the title might not appropriately reflect the resolution language in that case.
Okay, so the sponsor would not object to a title change reflecting adoption of Section 303?
Yes.
In the tax.
In the final conference report, yes.
Okay. Are there any other questions on the language of the bill? Let's see, I guess I have... I don't have any others. Is anyone seeing no other questions about the bill? We have two people to, or the resolution, we have two people to testify. Byron Butcher?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Government Affairs Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And the corporation strongly supports this legislation. Ever since the requirement that veterans be 1977 or earlier was put in, these five states have been working in Congress to try to get that changed. It, as a result of only having five states out of 50 that have this program, it's really not gone much of anywhere over the 15 years, and it's been much like banging our heads into the wall. This year, for the first time, it really looks promising. The language has been put in on the House side. We've been working with the Senate side. Our congressional delegation, Alaska, strongly supports it, as do the other four states. And this resolution would let the not only the delegation, but the members of the House and Senate know that we are in support of this. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about the program.
And how does the program work? I see in the fiscal note here, we've got basically $7 million through 131. I guess that's 06. Can you explain the fiscal note here and the table with that? Just a little bit for us.
Yes, I don't have the fiscal note in front of me.
Zero.
I think it's a zero fiscal note. What I saw had been prepared by.
There's a zero fiscal note, but there's a chart in there showing.
Mr. Chairman, this is a list of the number of loans that we have done. So there's no actual cost to the corporation. It's a benefit to the corporation because not only does it benefit veterans who can take advantage of the program, but it also benefits the corporation, obviously, because we get increasing mortgage loans. What the chart is showing is the gradual reduction of loans to veterans with every year as we get further and further away from the year veterans qualified. And it's gotten to the point where it's really of not much use at all to Oregon, Wisconsin, and Alaska, Oregon, and Wisconsin. Texas and California are large enough. There still is a fair pool of veterans, but like I said, it's certainly dwindling as we get further and further away from pre-1977.
And following up on that, I'm just trying to understand the effect of the program versus the Veterans Administration guarantee loan. How does this differ from that?
Mr. Chairman, this allows these states to sell tax-exempt bonds to fund mortgages. And so it's a break on what the normal mortgage rate would be based on the fact that we can sell tax-exempt bonds. It requires federal action to allow us to do that. As a result, to give you an example, for this week, our taxable mortgage rate is 6 3/8, but the veterans' mortgage rate is 5 3/4. So it depends on the price in which we get tax-exempt bonds and the interest rates. The higher the interest rates go, the larger the difference between our regular taxable rate and the vet's rate. But right now it's looking at about 5/8, over 0.5% lower for a vet's bond than for a regular taxable.
Good. Okay. Does anyone else have any further questions from AHFC?
Yeah.
Representative Gutter.
I think you said only five states do this so far. I'm not sure. Do what?
Mr. Chairman, through the Chair, Representative Gatto, only five states are eligible to sell tax-exempt bonds to fund a veterans program.
Okay.
Seeing no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
John Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Good morning. Great. Would you identify yourself and your affiliation for the record? And
My name is John Wilkins, and I'm Director of Services for the Disabled American Veterans, State of Alaska. My main job with the Disabled American Veterans, I'm a volunteer, but my job is to help veterans make sure they get what's coming to them, medical, mental, and on a situation like this, we want to step in and say this is a good program to help our veterans out. 0.5% is worth about $50 a month to a veteran, and veterans don't make that much money. Got a little bit written out here. Veterans in my age group have had a very good advantage with the present veterans mortgage program. I myself used the program to purchase my first home in Alaska, and it was cheaper than the VA loan. Looking at today's needs of veterans and service members, the 1986 Federal Tax Code hurts all the veterans from the end of Vietnam to present. Since 1977, we have been in a number of conflicts and wars. The veterans of these wars and conflicts are left out of the loop as far as obtaining a low-cost home mortgage, except for the VA loan. And that was just explained that can be anywhere from 0.5 point to 1 point higher than this Alaska mortgage loan. Today's military has many members that are married with family, especially our National Guard, the people that we're sending overseas. When we as military are deployed, we have a great deal of concern about our families, what's going to happen. They're in a rented house. Let's say there's a glitch in the system. Our paycheck's held up for 2 months. Well, is this landlord going to be compassionate to military, or is he going to say, hey, folks, you know, I want my money, get out? Well, a veteran or a service member that has a home, that's normally not going to happen. If there's a glitch in the system, the bank will work with you till it's straightened out. And the other thing about a service member having to worry about the family, service members that are on active duty, that are fighting a war, need to focus on that war. If you're in a war zone worried about your family, you just might take a bullet because you didn't pay attention to what was going on. So I'm asking this committee, if you would, please pass this House Joint Resolution number 25. It will help our veterans. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Williams? Thank you very much for taking your time and coming in.
Have a good day, please.
Do we have anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on the bill? Do we have anybody online? Seeing nobody online, seeing nobody here or online, I'll close the testimony. Representative Lynn.
Would you entertain a motion to move the legislation?
Not yet, okay. Representative Lynn. I would like to propose a conceptual amendment to the House, and that would be to take Section 303 from the end of the title and put it in the line one between adopt and add the word of. So it would read, urging the United States Congress to adopt Section 303 of the United States House of Representatives version of the Tax Relief Extension Reconciliation 2005. And this is a conceptual amendment so that the sponsor and the alleged legal will get the right wording. Is there any, this would be amendment number one. Is there any objection to amendment number one? Is there any member that wishes to hold this bill for further testimony or for any other work? Seeing none, Representative Lynn.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to move CS for HAL Joint Resolution number 25, MLV, 24-LS1274/I, with a zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
And Representative Lynn, that is
as amended.
As amended. Is there any objection to moving this bill, this resolution? Seeing none, House Joint Resolution 25, as amended, will move from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. And that will be the end of our committee for today. Sorry we didn't get to vehicle transactions, and we'll have that on our list as well as PERS and TERS reconciliation next time. We're adjourned.